It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, an FDA panel has recommended a new genetic treatment for leukemia. We'll learn how it works and what it means for the larger fight against cancer.
First, the White House announced today that financier and major Republican donor Anthony Scaramucci will take over as the White House Communications Director. Scaramucci currently serves as a senior advisor to President Trump. The announcement today led to the resignation of current White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer. Sarah Huckabee Sanders will step into Spicer's former role.
The news of the shakeup comes at a time when polls report low approval ratings for the president and an open investigation into the Trump campaign's ties to Russia. And Scaramucci's appointment has caused some strife in the White House.
Mike Wagner is an associate professor at UW-Madison's School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
It's my pleasure.
What is Anthony Scaramucci's background?
Well, he is a financier, a billionaire, a person who, by some reports, kind of ran a hedge fund of hedge funds for a time. He's also certainly played a big role in politics. He was actually a fundraiser for President Obama when he was Senator Obama in 2008, when he was first running for office, but then really started raising money in Republican circles shortly thereafter. He actually endorsed Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin for president in the early part of the Republican primaries, moved on to Governor Jeb Bush of Florida after Governor Walker dropped out of the race, and then to Donald Trump. He's most recently famous for getting a story about him and the Trump administration and potential or alleged ties to Russia retracted from CNN, which resulted in some reporters who worked for CNN no longer working there. And I think President Trump reportedly was enamored by that and shortly thereafter began talking to Mr. Scaramucci about the position in the White House.
And so he is a senior advisor to President Trump. What is his role? What kind of things is the president going to him for before this announcement?
Before this announcement, it's not quite clear what the precise role he played in the White House was, other than being an advisor that largely dealt with big picture financial matters and perhaps some communication matters. But now, as the communications director, he'll have more direct access, regular direct access to the president. He'll probably be a part if he does his position as predecessors historically have in shaping the broad message of the Trump White House, trying to find ways to communicate that message via the news media and other routes. He hinted strongly today, I think, that he is a fan of the way the president engages in communication, which often tries to bypass the traditional news media through outlets like Twitter and holding large rallies.
Well, and the president does, as you said, tend to bypass traditional routes of communication. What are the traditional background qualifications for communications directors, and does Scaramucci have any of those?
So usually communication directors have held a role similar to that on a smaller scale. Maybe for a U.S. senator or representative or a governor, or perhaps they worked as a communications director or press secretary on a presidential campaign. That's a traditional route to these kinds of jobs. So, for example, George Stephanopoulos was the communication director for Bill Clinton and served as the press secretary for the first 100-plus days of his term. Usually White House communication directors are people who played that same role on the campaign. They've had extensive experience in building relationships with the news media. Sometimes they come from media itself. Other times their experience is more in message crafting, message testing, and message dissemination throughout the public. He has less of those kinds of traditional qualifications than most White House communication directors have had.
And does this say something to you about what kinds of qualifications are valued by President Trump and his inner circle?
President Trump has hired a lot of people with very little experience in Washington, in top jobs, and he's hired a lot of people with very little experience in the areas in which they're working. And so many of them are wealthy. That's one thing many of them have in common. Many of them have strong ties to the financial sector, especially with respect to investing in banking. And so those are some areas that the people he hires seem to have in common across many important jobs. But he is not hiring people in the ways that modern presidents have traditionally hired them. You know, people who've worked up through that president's party, who've held other positions in government or have held similar positions outside of government, maybe in the industry that they might come to serve in the White House. Hasn't been the typical way that President Trump has gone about hiring most of its top staff.
We're talking with Mike Wagner right now. He's associate professor at UW-Madison's School of Journalism and Mass Communication. We're taking a look at the announcement that Anthony Scaramucci will be the new White House Communications Director and that White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer has submitted his resignation. Now, Mike, Sean Spicer was brought into the White House by Chief of Staff Reince Priebus, despite reservations from President Trump and his inner circle. Do you think that Sean Spicer stepping down, this new role for Anthony Scaramucci, puts Reince Priebus on even shakier ground than he has seemed to be previously?
Well, it's hard to know for sure. The reporting that I have seen has been mostly speculative on this front, or maybe had one or two at the most sources, and you know, in almost all cases, the sources are anonymous. But they've all pointed to the possibility that Reince Priebus is on shaky ground in his job as chief of staff. Reportedly, Priebus did not want Mr. Scaramucci to get hired, although his public statement after the hiring was a full-throated support of the decision. Politico reported today that some people in the Trump administration think that Scaramucci will actually end up in the position that Priebus has today, which is chief of staff, but that's all speculation at this point, and I'm not sure that any speculation is more valuable than any other right now.
The daily press briefings that Sean Spicer did became kind of a joke when he was press secretary and was lampooned by Saturday Night Live, being portrayed by Melissa McCarthy. He eventually stopped having televised press briefings. Do you think these last few months reflect on Sean Spicer or more on the White House and how it chooses to communicate?
This White House has a very different orientation toward the press than other White Houses in the modern era have had. Virtually anybody who's the president and virtually everybody who works for the president in a communications capacity views the news media in some way as though they're in an adversarial relationship where there are things that the president and the White House want reported, there are ways they would like that to be reported, and the news media, of course, is under no obligation to do things in the way the president wants them done. And so there's always a tension between the president and the president's staff and the news media, especially the White House press corps. But with President Trump, that really has been a tension on steroids, with not having these televised briefings, with kicking some news organizations out of private briefings, with regularly calling out particular members of the news media from the president himself, talking about how they are fake news or terrible reporters or liars. These are not things that traditional White House news media do, and President Trump especially, and he has directed his staff on some occasions to do the same thing, have done things in ways that are more brusque, more direct, and also sometimes defending things that are plainly false, which we tend not to see as much of. Every presidential administration shades the truth in ways that favor their side, but what we've seen from the Trump administration is far more brazen than what we've seen from other modern presidents.
And what do we know about how Anthony Scaramucci might be shaping that messaging from the White House Communications Department based maybe on how he has been as a defender of President Trump and his policies on for instance, the national news shows?
Well, yeah, Scaramucci has a background in some ways, or a rise to power in some ways that's similar to another President Trump communications staff person, Kellyanne Conway. Both worked for other candidates or supported other candidates early in the campaign and said negative things about Trump. But once Conway came on board, she's been unflinchingly loyal to the president, and reportedly Scaramucci's loyalty is of a similar kind, and President Trump reportedly values loyalty to himself and prizes that. And so far it seems like he's going to have it, and we didn't get much of a sense of what things might be like in the few questions that he answered from the press corps on camera today. But the last question, I think, or maybe the second to last question that he answered, was about how he saw the job. And when he responded to the reporter, he was saying, "Look, everybody has a radio station and a movie, you know, production house and a music production house in their phone now. It's a different world than it used to be, which to me was a signal that we shouldn't expect a traditional relationship between the White House press office and the news media.
And we'll leave it there. Mike, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Mike Wagner is an associate professor at UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. He joined us to talk about the White House press room shakeup.
Genetic treatments for serious illness are receiving a lot of research and discussion, but no gene therapy has made its way to the marketplace in the U.S. However, that may soon change after a decision by an advisory panel for the Food and Drug Administration.
The panel voted unanimously to recommend the approval of a genetic treatment for leukemia developed by Swiss drug company Novartis. Clinical trials showed promising results, but side effects are causing concern, and it's expected to be extremely expensive.
Alta Chero joins us now. She's a professor of law and bioethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Alta, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
What can you tell us about this breakthrough treatment and how it works?
Well, basically, we're talking about people who have a certain form of leukemia that can be lethal and sometimes doesn't respond to chemotherapy. What the physicians have done in these studies is to remove cells from the patient's body and then use so-called gene editing, which is the latest form of genetic engineering, to alter those cells in a way that makes them better at targeting cancer cells, and then reintroducing those cells into the patient's body, where these now edited cells will go find cancer cells and kill them. And so it is an example of what's known as CAR T therapy, and it's been a new exciting development in the world of medicine since about 2010.
What have we seen from the preliminary studies? How is it doing?
Well, right now, this particular form is doing incredibly well. So the latest study, which the Food and Drug Administration Advisory Panel was talking about a couple of weeks ago, had a success rate of up to about 85%. Now, this is with a small number of people, remember. It was about 55 people. There were children who had not responded to chemotherapy. So we're talking about folks that have already tried the standard approaches. And in this particular cohort, about 85% of them either got a remission or what looks like might be a long-term cure. Now, the others either developed the disease again, never actually went into remission. There were a couple of deaths. So this is not some kind of magic bullet yet. And for those that had a remission or a cure, there were also some very serious side effects, that company Novartis and other researchers are working hard to study and figure out how we might be able to avoid them. In particular, some really extreme inflammation that itself can be lethal.
And extreme fever in these young children.
Exactly. And the fever comes from the inflammation. So one of the effects of this treatment is for the body to release something called cytokines, and you get a cytokine storm which causes this inflammation. So in the future, ideally, it'll be possible to do this, remove cells, edit them so that their natural ability to fight cancer through the body's immune system is enhanced, but not have it at the same time also enhance the functions that cause this kind of cytokine storm.
This FDA panel recommended the treatment for people aged 3 to 25. Why did they limit their decision to younger patients?
Well, we're talking about a disease that has a particular effect on people in that age group. So we were looking for a group that suffers from the disease and where we've seen the non-response to chemotherapy. Now, this doesn't mean that it cannot be used with people who are older than 25, but that'll be a next step. Initially, the approval, which we expect will probably occur in September, will be based upon the very same kind of people who are in the trial. And then you slowly expand beyond that as we learn more about the therapy.
We're talking right now with Elta Sharo. She is a professor of law and bioethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We're discussing a genetic treatment for leukemia, which an FDA panel this month voted unanimously to recommend in treating this form of aggressive leukemia. Elta, when you treat leukemia patients, there's a traditional treatment, and now there is this type of treatment where you transform these living cells to attack the cancer. How do you decide, then, who gets a breakthrough treatment and who gets perhaps the chemotherapy and radiation and the traditional customary treatment?
Well, in fact, this particular development, this so-called breakthrough, as you're calling it, is really being used only for people who have failed on standard treatment because the side effects are so severe and the risks of actually getting sicker or even dying with this are significant enough that you don't start with this. You start with the standard therapies.
And this FDA panel, they voted unanimously. How much sway do these recommendations usually have?
They can be very influential. It's not that common, however, to get a unanimous recommendation. So that was really quite remarkable here. You know, the FDA has its own cadre of medical reviewers who are very expert at what they do. But when you have new and innovative kinds of therapies, or when you have clinical trials with complicated or ambivalent results, the FDA will frequently call in an expert panel. They have some standing panels for certain areas of medicine, and then sometimes an ad hoc panel just for a particular treatment. And they bring in people who are free of a conflict of interest. They don't have a financial stake in whether or not the particular treatment is going to be approved. And they have reams of information, fundamental data from trials, and then day or days even of testimony, and then a long conversation, and they do a kind of independent evaluation of the evidence. So given all that expertise and all of that deep research and review, their comments and their recommendations are often very influential.
This treatment, making an individual treatment for each patient, rewiring their individual cells, it can be very costly. Do we have any idea how expensive this could be?
Well, one figure I saw was $500,000. And this really is going to be one of the challenges. And we've seen it with some other kinds of biological therapies. The initial upfront cost can be exceedingly high. However, if it actually affects a cure, it means that you don't have decades of treatment, which over time could amount to far more than the cost of this one early treatment. So part of the problem is, how do you create a system that can handle these very high upfront costs with the expectation of a savings down the line? And that in turn is made more complicated by the fact that the insurance company today that might be asked to cover the $500,000 treatment may not be the same insurance company this person is on 10 years from now, when they're not using a lot of expensive chemotherapy and their future insurance company is now the one that's making the savings without having spent the money up front. And this is going to be a problem. How do we make sure that the savings and the initial costs are properly packaged so that insurance companies are incentivized to handle this kind of initial bill?
It's almost making humans like a living commodity.
It's not making humans a living commodity. It is part of what is going to become one of the trends in 21st century medicine. That is the use of gene editing in order to personalize treatments and be very precise in how it is that we either repair cells or grow new cells, or in this case, change cells so that they can become their own kind of biological drug. It's personalized medicine in the extreme, but it's not turning the person into a commodity. It's learning how to manipulate their cells to become drugs and curative devices.
If this is approved by the FDA, do you think we'll see a wave of genetic treatments for other cancers and other illnesses?
We're already seeing a tremendous amount of research in that area, and they come in different kinds of flavors. This one involves removing cells, editing them, and then reintroducing them. Another thing that would be very exciting would be to work with cells that come from generic donors so that you don't need to start with a patient's own cells, but you can have cell banks that have already been prepared with the various kinds of changes needed. That would be an immense improvement because it would make this much faster and it would simplify the manufacturing process, which right now is very individualized and rather tricky. We're also likely to begin seeing direct introduction of materials into the body that will, without taking cells out, will simply stimulate the body to start creating its own changes that would cure or at least ameliorate disease. These are things that are being worked on right now, and it's probably one of the most promising areas of medicine.
And quickly, Alta, as we wrap up, what is the timeline here as you look at it, getting this into hospitals and getting hospitals up to speed on how to do this type of treatment and when it will become more widely available to more patients?
That's a little hard to predict because right now, since it involves removing the cells from the patient, sending them off for special kinds of manipulation and then reintroducing them, we don't have a lot of sites around the country that are really able to perform all these steps. And indeed, Novartis for the moment is going to limit this to only about 30 or 35 hospital centers. I think it'll probably take years before this really becomes something that can become widely available.
Alta, thanks for taking the time to join us today.
Very happy to help. Thank you.
That was Alta Shero, professor of law and bioethics at UW-Madison, talking with us about an FDA panel recommending a genetic treatment for leukemia. It's Food Friday, and we've arrived at peak grilling season. It's that time when we enjoy a long summer evening and fire up the backyard grill with family and friends, knowing full well that whatever comes off the grill will be delicious.
Well, that is, as long as the one wearing the apron and holding the tongs knows exactly what they're doing. Dave Heide is here to help us with grilling and smoking. He's executive chef and owner of Charlie's on Main in Oregon and Liliana's in Fitchburg. Chef Dave, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me back.
So July may be peak grilling season, but grilling has really become a year-round way to cook, even way up north here in Wisconsin. Why do you think Americans love to grill so much?
I don't know. I think it's two big things. One, obviously, like the flavor. You know, everyone loves the smokiness. Although I will say, and we'll talk about this, I'm sure, later, but grilling may not even be one of the best ways to actually cook a meat in terms of a dry heat method. But the flavor that you get from it is incredible. I think the biggest reason why grilling is so fun is the kind of social aspect of it. You know, the like hanging around, everyone has a beer and the brats and communal eating. It's something that we don't do very often anymore. A lot of times when we do eat, it's going out to a restaurant and everyone's kind of quiet and huddled around their single plate. And then, you know, when you're on the barbecue, it's everyone kind of sitting and chatting and snacking.
I thought you were going to say it was that primal fire thing with meat on the fire.
Oh, there's that too.
That's what I love.
Oh, there's that too. But honestly, you know, we get that in so much other cooking
That's
nowadays
true.
Too. You know, everything is kind of primal in how we eat.
Well, let's cut right to the chase. What meat is absolutely right for the grill?
Well, beef, honestly, is like probably one of the best. Beef and pork. Ribeye is probably my favorite cut, if I were going to have one cut, and that's because it has enough marbling and fat in it to really grill well. You know, you want to stay away from things like filet mignon or light cuts of meat, and that's because they don't have enough fat in them to really withstand that dry cooking method that I just mentioned.
And the searing as well that comes out from the grill.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's some searing, but, you know, searing is probably one of the... you don't get that much searing ability from the grill itself. I mean, the only part that actually sears the meat on a grill are just where those bars are on your grill. So if you really want a great sear, actually one of the best methods is pan frying your steak. So the big thing for grilling, though, for me is, again, it's just about getting that flavor and the smokiness and that kind of caramelization and kind of carbony, smoky flavor.
And I have to say, I love putting chicken on the grill. One of the things that I've been doing, I was telling Kate about this earlier, I was going to do it today, but the weather's not cooperating, is I get a spatchcocked chicken. So, you know, ask the butcher to flatten it out. So it kind of looks like a chicken version of a little bearskin rug, and do that. But I've really had to play around with getting more heat on the thicker parts and a little less heat on the other parts. Are there some meats that you take a little more attention like that?
More finesse. Yeah. Seafood in particular takes a lot of attention and a lot of working with. I would say for chicken, you know, Americans have this fascination with breasts, chicken breast, I guess both, to be fair. But we have this fascination with chicken breasts as the meat of choice, but it's really the worst part of the chicken in terms of flavor. Maybe in terms of health, it's fine, but really it's the least flavorful part of the bird. The legs and the thighs are totally where it's at. So especially on the grill, I mean, if you put a chicken breast on the grill, it's too thick. It dries out too much on the outside. It's by the time you get it cooked all the way through, it's so dried out. My recommendation is go legs and thighs if you're going for chicken, and you end up with a much moister bird and much more flavor too.
What would you recommend for fish that works well on the grill? Because fish can really fall apart.
Yeah, I don't normally cook fish on a grill, and it doesn't hold up well. But also, like, it's basically, if you want to cook something on a grill, it's got to have a ton of fat. So the things, like I said, like big pork and beef do great. If you really want to do fish on the grill, definitely skin on. So trout, anything you get out of the lake, you know, for the most part, depends on which lake. And then also things like salmon does really great because it has that nice high fat content. So,
do you put it right on the grill, or are you putting it in foil and then on the grill?
No, I do it right on the grill. The biggest thing that people have a problem with is getting things that stick all the time on their grill.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually have a grilling class at Liliana's where we show you all the techniques and stuff you can do to kind of do a better grilling. But the two things that you should always do for your grill is, number one, preheat the ever-loving heck out of it. And then number two, just make sure it's really clean. And the reason why it's important to have a clean grill, it's not so that you get the flavor from other items that were on there, but it's because what that buildup is it's a buildup of carbon, which is an insulator. And so if it's an insulator, it won't transfer heat, and that'll cause sticking. So by cleaning your grill, that removes all the carbon that's on your metal, and therefore it'll get a better sear.
We're talking right now with Dave Heide, and we're learning about grilling and smoking. Here we are in the height of grilling season, learning how to grill and smoke meat and learning about what fish to use on the grill. And so, Dave, wondering what you think about the essential tools for grilling. What do we need when we are around the grill?
Number one is a grill brush, again, to keep your grill clean. And then tongs are great. Weber has a great one that I use when I'm outdoor grilling that's got a flat spatula on either side, so it's a lot easier for grilling and turning. Skewers are fantastic. But, you know, really grilling, again, we talked about primal earlier. just use your hands, you know? I mean, it's great.
Especially if you have, you know, like asbestos-covered hands.
No,
right?
You just have chef hands. That's what we do. They're all covered in calluses.
My mother had chef hands, so I can appreciate that. So a lot of people, well, I think people worry that they're not going to cook something long enough because it looks like it's done on the outside, especially if it's at high heat and stuff, and it's not going to be done. Some people are really kind of obsessed with checking the progress of food on the grill. And if the grill is closed and you keep opening it, is that a bad thing? Is that like opening the oven too often?
Yes and no. It depends on the kind of grill you have. I think one of the biggest things that happens when you open up the grill, yes, it releases heat, which just means it'll take longer. But the biggest problem is that all of that smokiness from the fat dripping down, when the fat drips down onto the fire and releases all that smoke, that kind of gives it that smoky flavor. And when we open up the grill, then all that smoke kind of goes out. So you're not really smoking your meat when you cook it on a grill, but you're definitely imparting that smoky flavor, which again, I think is why we want it on the grill in the first place, is for the flavor.
You said smoking and flavor, and I just have to get to these smoked ribs that you shared with us. Chef Dave's smoked ribs, you can find them on the Central Time Facebook page. Break down this recipe for us. Tell us what's in it.
Well, so the biggest thing with ribs, and so the recipe that I gave you guys is a great recipe, but really, honestly, even if it's just oil, salt, and pepper, the most important thing when you're smoking ribs is just how you smoke it. I know a lot of people are intimidated by smoking because they don't have a smoker, they don't do it very often, but the most important thing when you're smoking is just really nice, low heat for a nice, long period of time. You can absolutely smoke something in a 350 degree oven with smoke going around it and cook it in that same amount of time that you'd cook a regular piece of meat on a grill. But the whole thing that's great about smoking is that really low heat with smoke for a long period of time. So,
and do you use that? There are a lot of herbs in your recipe. Do you use all dried herbs for the rub?
For the rub, yes. And again, because we're doing that kind of long smoke, we kind of make a paste out of the spices and herbs. And then rub them on. So you want kind of a dried herb because it'll soak up some of that oil that's in that marinade and kind of help it form into that paste to help it hold on while it's smoking.
Even if I have fresh oregano in the garden?
You can use whatever makes you happy.
No, I want
words
it from
to
the
live
chef.
By
yes, yes.
I personally would still use that and then save the fresh, beautiful oregano for something else.
All right. Well, do you do anything to the ribs before you put the rub on them?
Great question. You know, some people are, you know, diehard briners. They really think you should brine them first. Some people braise them first before they put them in a smoker. I'm just a purist. I like it just with a rub on it and then in the smoker, slow and low.
Slow and low for about 2 hours. More or longer.
Yeah, probably like around like 6 hours.
6 hours.
Yeah, like around 6 hours for a nice low smoke. Now, again, that's if you're smoking it at like 220 degrees. Now, if you're smoking it at like 250 or 275, like if you don't have a temperature regulation, then you're going to want to, you know, do it for a shorter period.
Do they need to rest then at all?
Smoking is different than cooking a grill. So if you're cooking it on a grill, then absolutely it needs to rest. If it's coming off a smoker, you take it and you just saw into it and gnaw into it.
Drooling here. We're talking about grilling and smoking meat on this Food Friday. Chef Dave Heide is here to give us the tips and tricks to grill like a pro. He's executive chef and owner of Charlie's on Main in Oregon and Liliana's in Fitchburg.
We want to hear about your grilling achievements at 800-642-1234. What do you like to grill? Have you smoked meat before? Did you get the outcome you hoped for? Do you have any family recipes that you can share for smoking and grilling meat or fish? And what questions do you have for Chef Dave? Join in at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our Food Friday conversation about grilling and smoking meat with Chef Dave Heide. He's executive chef and owner of Charlie's on Main in Oregon and Liliana's in Fitchburg.
And you can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. How often do you grill? What do you love to throw on the grill? Have you learned any tricks through trial and error? And something we like to talk less about, cleaning the grill. How do you go about cleaning your grill? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234, or post your techniques over on the Central Time Facebook page. Let's go right to the phones now with Julie in Mazamani. Hi, Julie.
Hi, how are you?
Good, go ahead.
Well, first I want to clarify, cleaning grills is not my thing. That is not in my job description.
Nice.
But my family loves to grill, and we love the taste of the meat that's been smoked or done over a flame. So a few years ago, I decided to really push the envelope and start experimenting with larger cuts of meat, like roast. And we have discovered that a lamb roast done on the grill is absolutely the best thing in the whole world. It's super easy, it's tender, and there's so much fat in lamb that you kind of don't have to do anything.
Mm. Yeah, a great cut of lamb that I love is the lamb belly, and the belly actually does a really great job of, you kind of roll it up just like you would kind of like a pork belly, but it's got enough fat in it that it really goes through. Some of the other roasts, like the leg and whatnot, does pretty well. One of the things that you want to really think about when you're doing something on the grill is that it's really hard on most grills to really regulate temperature well. And when you have something like a big roast, it really wants to have that slow and low cooking. So especially like a leg, it really wants to be cooked for like, you know, 2 to 4 hours on a lower heat to really get that elastin to break down. So I think there's some great cuts of lamb to go on there. Same thing with other big roasts. I think they're great, but you really want to make sure you're picking something that's not tough and chewy to begin with, or it's going to still be tough and chewy when you pull it off a regular grill.
Julie, thanks so much for calling in with your question. And Chef Dave, I know we have a number of vegetarians out there. What about cooking veggies on the grill or perhaps tofu?
Yeah, totally. You know, we do, we have a whole vegetarian vegan menu at both Liliana's and Charlie's. My whole family is vegetarian, so we definitely pick up on that. You know, I think the best thing for me, always like corn and peppers and onions and doing a whole big saute, mushrooms. Mushrooms are like the steak of the vegetarian world. So so definitely any kind of mushroom period is great for me.
Do you marinate vegetables or brush them with anything?
I do a lot of that post-grilling. Mm. If you put, I had someone who asked me earlier about flare-ups on the grill.
that would be me. Full disclosure, I have actually lost entire meals in a fiery inferno.
One of the things that causes a flare-up is too much grease on your produce or on your meat that happens. And so if you marinate your vegetables ahead of time too much, you can end up with a lot of flare. So if you are going to marinate your vegetables, I recommend doing it with like balsamic vinegar and herbs and spices and maybe a little bit of oil. Mm-hmm. And then if you want more oil flavor, then put that on at the end after you've cooked
more
it.
Of a finish in that way.
Let's go to the calls again. Bruce in Cable. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. I was up in Alaska visiting, and they have smoked salmon up there, very popular, especially for the locals. They call it squaw candy, and it's a real sweet smoked salmon. And I'm just wondering how I could do that on my home grill or my home, back here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, so smoking fish is a little different than smoking meats. Usually when you do smoked fish, you'll want to do it over cold smoke. So that's when you have the smoke, instead of directly over flame and smoke, you have the smoke come up from a separate chamber and go in. So cold smoke doesn't mean it's like 32 degrees when it's smoking. It just means that it's a much cooler smoke than directly over flame. So that's how I do our smoked fish. If you have a gas smoker, you can also set it at a really, really, really low flame. But again, when you're trying to get enough, the problem is if you try and smoke a fish, if you do it on a high heat, it's not going to get any smoke flavor before it dries out and becomes overcooked. So you want to have something that can have a really low temp.
Well, great. What about putting?
Pudding doesn't work very well.
What about fruit on the grill? Sweet endings. I know.
Good.
You want to put a peach on the grill or something.
Pineapple.
Pineapple.
Yeah, actually, peach and pineapple are two of my favorites for grilling. Watermelon does a really good job. But wait.
Watermelon on the grill?
Yeah, watermelon on the grill. It's really good. But you have to do really clean, really hot grill and just kind of flash it. And if you cook it for too long, it'll break down. So it's just to give it that little bit of smoke and then hit it with a little bit of salt right afterwards, and it brings out the sweetness. It's great.
That sounds really good. Well, so we've been talking so much about that flavor that's imparted by smoke. What about wood chips? Do you use wood chips for smoking in when you're just regular grilling, or do you feel like that's just kind of icing on
no,
a cake that's
wood,
not needed?
Wood chips, absolutely, for smoking. That's where we get all of our smoke flavor from. It depends on what kind of smoker you have. If you have one of those really big smokers, some of them use pellets, some of them use like wood chunks, some of them use chips. Most of mine use chips. Just remember to soak your chips ahead of time. That's what's going to make them actually smoke and not just burn. So you want to, that'll make them last a lot longer as well. So you just want to make sure if you are going to use chips that you do let them soak first.
So use them just with the smoker, or can you also use chips on your grill?
If you use chips on the grill, it's mostly just going to make some smoke. Again, you know, the way you impart smoked flavor on something is a long exposure to that smoke. Just taking, you know, a little bit of fire underneath with a little bit of smoke isn't really going to change the flavor that much. If you want to add a little bit of smoky flavor and you don't have an outdoor smoker and you want to do it at home, one thing you can do is you can get two pots And you can put the range on low, put some moist wood chips in the bottom with foil protecting your pot, and then just put it right on your range and let the temperature come up until you start to see a little bit of smoke. Put a rack in there, and then you can put another pot or aluminum foil over the top and just keep an eye and that it's on low heat, and you can end up smoking your own food in your house.
Keep an eye on it.
And probably run the fan above
and keep
it.
Your fan going.
Well, let's go to Gary now in Rhinelander. Hi, Gary.
Hi there. I am definitely a solid charcoal griller. I mean, I don't like gas grill. Otherwise, you might as well just do it in the house is the way I look at it. But on a charcoal grill, I mean, we charcoal steaks very often. And it doesn't take more than about 7 minutes to do the steaks that we get, and because we like them medium to medium rare and such, and it's got a great flavor. We charcoal out year round. And 2 years ago, I'd received an electric smoker, which, okay, wasn't so happy about electric, but... My wife uses it often only because she has the time, and she makes, ribs that you would die for. I mean, we go about 145 degrees in our electric smoker for about 4 hours, and we do four slabs at a time, and then we let it rest and cool it in tinfoil. And then we will rewarm it up in the oven for about 45 minutes, and it comes off the bone just like you want it to.
That sounds great, Gary. And so, Dave, electric smoker, charcoal grill, we didn't actually talk about the different options.
So charcoal grills, I absolutely love. They're great. I think the biggest inconvenience is the inconvenience. You know, you've got to wait for them to...
The timing,
the preheating, and also inconsistency in temperatures that goes around. Flavor-wise, I think it's great. But I think a lot of... what makes people love charcoal is the nostalgia of growing up with charcoal. You know, when you grew up tasting charcoal with the family, and again, that whole social aspect we talked about before, you know, when you grew up and that was what it was, when you tasted that charcoal, it was being with your family. A lot of people impart those feelings into the grill as well. So in terms of an electric smoker, electric smokers are fine. In Wisconsin, the only thing I don't recommend about an electric smoker is that they have a much harder time keeping temperature consistent compared to a gas smoker. So if you're looking at a gas smoking purchase, or a smoker purchase for outdoors, I would definitely recommend a gas one over electric. But electric is great, too. It just means you have a shorter season, so you won't be able to go out in, you know, 18 degree below zero weather and smoke.
And Carly in Cumberland, Wisconsin, is vegan and wants some vegan grilling ideas.
Some other vegan grilling ideas? So we make our own seitan from scratch at Liliana's. And seitan does a really good job on the grill, and you can even smoke it really well. We've done smoked seitan at our restaurant. And that turns out really good. We also, at both our restaurants, we have smoked tofu, and the smoked tofu is incredibly good. We pan sear it. It's got chimichurri, and it's really good. So, you know, I don't recommend using any of the, like, pre-purchased fake meats when you're smoking. Mm-hmm. They work fine on a grill, but they don't really do that good a job in a smoker.
Can you leave us with one key piece of advice before we go fire up the grill, perhaps tonight?
Clean your grill. And then don't forget to clean your grill.
How clean is clean?
Oh my God, clean your grill. No, so like you have to just clean the grill so that there's no carbon buildup. Okay. Because every single person who says my meat stinks, I'm just like, just clean your grill. And they clean it and they're like, oh my God, it fixed it. And I'm like, yeah. Then.
Well, Chef Dave, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course, more than happy to.
That was Dave Heide. He is executive chef and owner of Charlie's on Main in Oregon and Liliana's in Fitchburg. And we have been getting tips on grilling and smoking meat. And we're still looking for your suggestions on what you grill, what you love to just take right off the grill over on the Central Time Facebook page, and also some recipe suggestions. You can find Chef Dave's smoked ribs. You can find that recipe suggestion over on the Central Time Facebook page. what to do with all the fresh fruit in season. Beth Campbell of Belleville, Wisconsin can school us. She won the National Pie Championships recently in Orlando, Florida with her apple bourbon bacon pie. She entered pies in 10 different categories.
And there is actually a challenger very close to home in her own kitchen, her husband, Charlie, who used to just indulge in her pies and act as her sous chef helping in the kitchen. Now he's entering his own pies and he has actually won a ribbon one time.
The National Championships are an annual tradition for the Campbells. They drive 22 hours to Florida with their van loaded down with kitchen utensils and coolers stuffed with ingredients like cream. They are convinced that you just can't get it better in Wisconsin, no doubt there. They've taken the American cultural icon apple pie to a whole new level.
I have to say there is nothing about this pie recipe that doesn't appeal to me. The salty, sweet, smoky, boozy.
It's all there.
It's all there. And this has three different fillings plus a topping. This is not throw it together.
This is very elaborate.
So
pie.
Congratulations to Beth Campbell of Belleville, Wisconsin. Feel free to send us an apple bourbon bacon pie anytime you want.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.